It's All Things Considered from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. We're still waiting for a quiet week in state politics, so here to review some of what happened in the Raleigh political bubble this week are Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the progressive NC Policy Watch. Hi.
Hello. Hello, guys.
We are in the fourth week of a budget standoff, no end in sight. Don't want to spend too much time on this because I don't think there is a lot of new ground to cover, but briefly from each of you, is it more of a failure or a function of government that we seem to be entrenched at this impasse?
No, I think it's definitely a failure. We are in a situation where we ought to be having negotiations. That's what you have when you have a legislature and a governor that can't agree on a budget. They should negotiate, and it's that simple. And the fact that we're not having any negotiations, that they're not even sitting down and talking and can't get any counteroffers out of the legislative leadership is a failure, I'd say.
I think it's a failure, too. Luckily, we did have a law put in place that in a situation like this, where there is not a budget, a new budget to be enacted, we just defer to last year's spending. Now, what we're seeing, too, this week is some stopgap bills that are putting some stopgap funding in place for things like some of the federal block grants that are coming in, really funding very important DHHS projects. There's been the public school enrollment growth that was part of that. So some of these things that are very critical for government to continue are being addressed, or at least they're moving through the General Assembly. And I think for, you know, those of us that watch this every day, this is really important, sort of the drama and the intrigue and the going back and forth and finger pointing and, you know, all of that. But I think for regular folks, you know, I mean, they can still go to the DMV and get their driver's license and, you know, I think we're safe in North Carolina because of public safety and law enforcement. And, you know, so I think for regular folks, they're kind of watching this on Jones Street, but at the same time, their lives are going on uninterrupted.
And we hope so. But we know that they're also probably, if they are paying any attention, lamenting the fact that we're sort of importing the sort of gridlock and dysfunction of Washington now to Raleigh. For years, North Carolina has not had this problem where we've had, you know, a governor of one party and the legislature of the other party. We've figured out ways to broker a deal. And now that we've gone to this situation this time in 2019, we just can't seem to have a can't get a deal.
And I think Rob and I might disagree on what the deal should look like. But I think we're in agreement. Yeah, you know, I mean, there ought to be some kind of deal that's made to move these things forward, because there's a lot of provisions in that budget that are not getting done because of this stalemate.
At a partisan gerrymandering trial in state court, a relatively dramatic moment on Thursday when an expert witness for the defense had his own analysis unraveled before the court as a series of factual errors, misinformation, and fundamental flaws were exposed under cross-examination. The testimony of Douglas Johnson, an understudy, the late Tom Hoffler, was ultimately stricken largely from the record, the judges ruling his work was not reliable. Was this a big deal, a medium deal, or not really all that much of a deal at all?
I think it's a big deal. I think any time that you have factual errors, you know, particularly in a case like this with the gerrymandering, where there's a lot of percentages and how districts have voted in the past, and there's a lot of math involved with that, and it's important to get that right. And I think, you know, I think this is a big deal. I think it's embarrassing for that expert witness to have, you know, had this disclosed. I think it's, you know, it's embarrassing for the defendants. I think it's embarrassing for anybody that would be involved with that. So I think that it is, you know, I think it's a big deal.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I think it could be a mortal blow. This witness, as best we can tell, was really the only witness that the Republicans were putting on, the defendants were putting on, that could refute the finding that Hoffler drew the maps ahead of time. And if, in fact, that we have compelling expert testimony from the plaintiffs that it's clear that Hoffler did, then that reaffirms the point that's been made that the defendants lied to a federal court about the ability to have a special election, and that's a big deal. So I think this has big implications for this case. I think it conceivably could have implications for the other case that's going on right now in North Carolina court about the legitimacy of the General Assembly adopting these constitutional amendments. So I think it's a super big deal, and it could be a big, big problem. And I frankly think that the lawyers for the defendants, if they had some clients who, you know, in some ordinary litigation might be considering whether they committed malpractice by putting on such an incompetent witness.
But something else, too, and there have been kind of some surprise moments, and some things have been widely reported, some not so much. And one that I do think is a big deal that has not gotten a lot of attention yet is the testimony of Bill Gilkerson, who was a former General Assembly staffer. I think he started here in the 1980s. His specialty was election law. He staffed the Elections and Redistricting Committee during that time, helped draw the maps in 1991, again in 2001. Then, as a private lawyer with this expertise, helped to draw those maps in 2017 as part of the Covington remedial maps. And, you know, what we heard from his testimony was he met regularly with the Democrat leadership, with the Democrat members of the General Assembly in both the House and the Senate. He considered partisan information. He discussed with them what those specific districts, as they were being drafted and proposed, how those maps performed politically. And so I think what that tells us is this partisan gerrymandering has occurred under Democrat leadership with Democrat map drawers, as is alleged in this case with the Republican map drawer. So it seemed to me that was another kind of takeaway from this week in the case.
And how would you respond in brief to the argument to the point that that isn't what's on trial here?
Well, that's true, but I think it's a little ironic, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really speak to, you know, what's admissible
neither
and, you know, those, those kind of things. But it does seem ironic to me that a person who has been key to this, who has been deposed in this case, who was called to the stand for close to an hour of testimony on the Democrat side, you know, if you kind of forget who's talking and, you know, interchange Bill Gilkerson with Tom Hoffelter, though, you know, in many cases, the discussions that they had and the things that supposedly took place in the discussions and who was in the room were very similar.
I don't think anybody has any doubt. It's always been acknowledged that the Democratic Party engaged in gerrymandering, has engaged in gerrymandering when they were in control of the General Assembly. The problem is that the Republicans are now in charge. They are the ones who have used partisan gerrymandering to draw these maps. They are clearly in violation of the North Carolina Constitution. I think that's what the courts are going to find. And this is going to be just completely not even an issue, the fact that the testimony of Mr. Gilkerson. So I just think it's a red herring, and it's attacking the messenger when the real issue here is what the people in charge did, and that what they clearly did was gerrymander for partisan gain.
But if it was unconstitutional when Republicans did it, why is it not unconstitutional when Democrats did it?
Absolutely,
is it just
was.
No, is it just nobody? Nobody brought that to
you know there were
nobody
actually,
brought that forward.
Actually,
nobody
well,
brought that as the subject of a lawsuit.
The Republicans,
the partisan lawsuits. Well, I mean, that's what this lawsuit is about.
That's
the Common Cause v. Lewis is
sure.
Partisan gerrymandering. What we heard from Bill Gilkerson is the Democrats were doing that as well.
Just for a little clarity, there has been a successful gerrymandering. There are plenty of successful gerrymandering lawsuits, but there was one filed by Republicans against Democrats 17 years ago, I believe.
Yeah.
Your point being that that had more to do with racial gerrymandering than partisan gerrymandering. I think you just said that. You're saying that was not a partisan gerrymandering challenge. This is the first partisan gerrymandering challenge we've had.
Yes,
and that is true.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and Rob wouldn't argue. I don't think.
Right.
Well, let's pose this.
Some smart
question.
Lawyers have come up with a theory that they could do that. I mean, it's the law continues to evolve and to get to a higher place. And we now know that we can actually bring a partisan gerrymandering lawsuit. I guess maybe people didn't think to do that back then. It's a great development.
Well,
I think
if they'd have brought it then,
that would have been a good thing, too. And that's why you and I and the John Locke Foundation have together spoken so adamantly and regularly over the years for an end to partisan gerrymandering and for redistricting reform. It was bad when the Democrats did it. It's bad now.
The most interesting policy debate this week, I think, for my money, over hemp, smokable hemp. More than 40 states have enacted legislation to establish industrial hemp cultivation as well as production programs that farmers can partake in. Now, all along this divide here, along this argument, farmers say that they would reap revenue, and they're backing this. So too are veterans, smaller group, but an important one. They say that this would help individuals who suffer from PTSD. However, law enforcement are warning that the plant looks too much like marijuana and could lead to some challenges with law enforcement. Where are each of you on this issue, and why?
My favorite explanation was, I think it was last week, Representative Jimmy Dixon, who since I think has done a flip-flop on this, who said in committee that the reason we didn't want to legalize smokable hemp was because this would put police dogs out of a job, and it would not allow for us to have excuses to search people when they smell what they think is marijuana smoke. I mean, if that didn't show you how absurd this law is, I mean, come on. It's 2019. We've had thousands of comments on our website from people who are angry about this attempt to keep this illegal. It clearly should be legalized. Traditional marijuana should be legalized in North Carolina, and this is just a complete waste of time that we haven't done that already.
That state lawmaker also did do a 180 on
right.
his position within
right.
the last week.
Right.
Just perhaps worth noting.
Had some
right.
farmers
and, yeah,
get to him,
right.
I think.
And the thing about the police dogs was really brought up by law enforcement. I think it was maybe the SBI. Whoever's in charge of police dogs
right.
in North Carolina had brought that point up. It was in one of the committee meetings, of course.
Are the dogs concerned about losing their job?
The dog
Someone
handlers
maybe,
are
maybe they could be treated to trained to sniff out white-collar crime. Maybe that would help us in this state.
Where are you on this issue?
You know, I'm not... I think it raises some really interesting policy issues. I mean, I don't know that I have a position on it, because I've been watching this debate very closely, attending the committee meetings, just because it is so darn interesting. And also the people that are there, you know, we're seeing farmers that are coming in, as you mentioned, they are veterans and representatives of veterans associations that are dealing with mental health issues that veterans face. A lot of, there's also been cancer patients who have gotten relief from the CBD oil that is contained in the hemp products. So it's a real wide variety of people that are interested in this, and the committee meetings have been packed. Just the discussion as you sit in committee meetings with sitting next to somebody about why they're there and what their positions are and those kind of things has been really interesting. But what you have here is, an emerging industry that has kind of been opened up at the federal government level and then kind of pitched to the states to say, okay, you all figure this out. And Jeff, as you mentioned, there have been states that are moving forward with this. North Carolina is kind of front and center with this discussion because with our, and this is from talking to some of the farmers in the audience and who have been visiting the General Assembly, that our tobacco farmers, their skill knowledge, the equipment that they have, how they farm, the land that they're using to farm on is very similar for hemp as it is for tobacco. So it's an easy or reasonable transition from one to the other. So North Carolina is kind of front and center because of that, because there's so much potential for that industry. But like with any industry, you want to make sure that there are safeguards in place, that government's role is to put those guardrails in place, tax fairly, protect public safety and public health, and then get out of the way and let an industry grow.
But is there any, from your perspective, is there really any concern here over public safety?
Well, what we hear from the law enforcement community, and particularly the DAs, and
right.
the DAs, the sheriffs, and the police chiefs all have testified in these committees about that. Their concern is you cannot tell, a regular person right. and a police officer cannot tell the difference between a bag of marijuana and a bag of hemp flowers. And so if they stop someone, somebody could say, well, this is a legal product. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a law enforcement officer, but there are complications that I have to trust them when they say this is a problem. It seems to me that the easy solution to this is to have some sort of technology that a police officer could drop a few leaves of whatever is in these bags into some kind of device and get a reading on what it is. That technology is being developed. There are devices that are pretty far along that I understand have been floated with some law enforcement officers to try it. Obviously, you'd have to get it right in order to do that, but that's not available right now. So there's not really a solution to the problem that the law enforcement has brought forward.
I think I know where you are on this one, but an even quicker solution would be to legalize marijuana in the state, as Rob mentioned.
But I think we're...
That's not going to happen, but philosophically, is that, would you be okay with that?
I would be fine with that. But I'm also, you know, I spend a lot of time down here at the General Assembly, you know, as you do. And I know these legislators.
It might help,
and
you.
That has been that has been proposed for a number of years. And
right.
I don't think we're quite ready for that. So although the three of us may agree, seems like a logical solution to this problem, I think pragmatically, that's not what we're going to see.
It'll probably go in steps, just like we've done with other things. We make slow progress in hemp. You know, smokable hemp will probably be one step, and then they'll realize that it's silly, and then eventually they'll just follow the lead of the rest of the country.
Mercifully, the saga of Republican House Representative Cody Henson came to a conclusion today. He announced his resignation Wednesday, and it took effect this afternoon. He pled guilty Tuesday to cyberstalking his now-estranged wife. According to court documents, Henson threw a full can of beer at his pregnant wife in front of the couple's other child, brandished guns on social media, and told her he was a killing machine. Henson is a veteran. An order of protection had been issued against Mr. Henson 5 months ago. Candidly, there is a lot that I don't understand about this place, but this one truthfully perplexed me. Why did it take so long for him to resign?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm kind of perplexed about that, too. But I think the point on this is he has resigned. He has had some court-ordered psychological help, counseling that's been ordered. He says he wants to spend time with his two children, which, you know, I think is a positive thing. It's time to move on. It's time to let him move on. I hope the very best for him and his family and certainly his children. And I think it's Iredale County. They may represent several counties, but, you know, they will be meeting to find a replacement for him. I think this is all positive. Let's be positive in that he will get the help that he needs, move on with his life, and things at the General Assembly will go back to the crazy normal that we have.
I mean, I think it was an absurd abdication of responsibility by the Speaker of the House to remain silent on this for months and months. I mean, to sit down with this man in your caucus meetings and just pretend like business as usual, and to allow him to be in a position where he was trying to represent people, women who were victims perhaps of domestic violence who were coming to the General Assembly. We had this absurd situation where he didn't vote on a bill that involved domestic violence. I mean, that was just, it was outrageous. It's months of wasted time. It's months in which people were not properly represented. And, you know, I think the Speaker should apologize for having been so absent in AWOL in performing his duties.
Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekends.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks, guys.